So now I'll introduce chapter 60 to 62. You all going okay? Absent from these chapters here, there are three unusual chapters, are the concerns that have permeated what we did last week or this week. All those concerns, they're not there. The injustices that are dividing the post-exilic community, that have marginalised the servants responsible for the final section of Isaiah's scroll, you don't find them mentioned here in these three chapters we're about to look at. Chapter 60 to 62 read as though they belong to the period shortly after the return from exile. Don't forget they've all been edited in here, stitched in. When the dream of rebuilding a temple even more glorious than that of Solomon was still alive, and before the grab for power caused the divisions in the community about which we've been hearing. And one of the main grabs for power, of course, was for the priesthood in the temple. Certain groups claiming to descend from Aaron took over, and the other priests were demoted to be Levites. So there were problems with it. But and all through the Torah, you get different opinions in different books. According to the book of Deuteronomy, every Levite has the right to minister and offer sacrifices to God. According to the priestly group, equals the Aaronic priesthood. No, they're only allowed to prepare the sacrifices. So there's a grab for power in the priesthood. That would surprise you. So it was going on there too. So you're dealing with human beings. We're always dealing with human beings, thanks be to God. And thank God so many of them are beautiful. So the focus of these oracles here in chapter 60 to 62 is not on human justice or injustice, but on the grand design and promise of Yahweh. So in a way, we're relaxing a bit. The prophet preachers are addressing Jerusalem. Let's listen to what they say. Arise, shine, for your light has come. The glory of Yahweh has risen upon you. Though darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness the peoples, Yahweh rises upon you, and his glory appears over you. Nations shall come to your light, kings to the splendor of your dawn. So it's a missionary, it's very beautiful after what we've been hearing. It's a very beautiful picture of the dream there for Jerusalem. And some of it is quoting or alluding to earlier prophecies from Isaiah ben Amoz there. Lift up your eyes and look around. They're gathering together. They're coming to you. Your sons will come from far away. Your daughters will be held on the hip. The beautiful experience of the people in Jerusalem seeing all the exiles coming back from north, south, east and west, coming home. Maybe you can just picture the delight of all that. Then you'll see and be radiant. Your heart will thrill and rejoice because the abundance of the sea shall be brought to you. The wealth of the nations will come to you. A multitude of camels shall cover you, young camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba shall come, up from Saudi Arabia, really, the south part of Yemen, really. They're coming, more camels. They shall bring gold and frankincense and shall proclaim the praise of Yahweh. Can you see Matthew's gospel in that midrash? Darash in Hebrew means to search. And midrash is what you find when you search. Makes that. So midrash is what we're doing all the time. There's nothing terribly obscure about it. But they searched the scriptures to find meaning in their present situation. And they searched their present situation to find meaning in the scriptures. You know, it's a mutual search, which we do when we have prayer groups. You do it all the time. It's natural. So it's that searching. And so Matthew, among his community at probably Antioch, was searching the scriptures to try to get an understanding of Jesus. And he begins with two chapters of Midrash, meaning poetic, homiletic, imaginative writings, because they know nothing. The Gospel of Matthew begins in chapter 3 with the baptism. All the Gospels begin with the baptism. But prior to that, he hasn't got a lot of factual material. He's got dreams. He's got trying to present on the stage, like the backdrop of the stage before the play actually begins. And it begins with with Jesus as an adult being baptized. That's when the mission started. So before that, he's got this one of the stories is about the wise men from the east coming on, well, you've got to imagine them on camels, and they're bringing gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Myrrh doesn't fit into that text, but myrrh is the ointment of death, suffering, you know, burial. So can't you see? They're not telling you what happened. There were three, because it doesn't say three, by the way, and kings, it doesn't say kings. Read the text. It's just magi, wise. So all wisdom comes from the east, because that's where the sun rises. No other reason than that. So it's the place, the light, the rising sun from the east. I suppose Japan picked that up, did it? Because it's in East Asia. You've got China and the rest of it going west. So the same idea of the wisdom coming from the east. Well, they're coming, but where are they coming to in Matthew? They're coming to the Messiah. They're coming to the answer to all these dreams. So they paint this picture, and that's what it is. It's a painted picture for us, which is still can capture our imagination. Chapter 60, verse 7, these verses continue to speak of Yahweh's blessing. And how different this sounds from the way things actually turned out. That promise that we've just read never happened, except if you see the Gentile church in the post-resurrection period coming to Jesus. That's when it happened, when Judaism went right out to the whole world and thousands and thousands of people became Christians, because it was about love. And it wasn't about bong, 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 theological accuracy and all that, important as that is. So in chapters 56 to 59, the community is divided, actually. 60 would have been probably an earlier dream. But when you looked at it, no, they were very divided. The poor are suffering the violence of rampant injustice. We've just read about that. Jude is in a state of chronic depression. Salvation is urgently prayed for but not experienced. That's the fact on the ground. It's in this situation that the author of chapter 60 and the other servants of Yahweh cling to their faith against all the odds. They're keeping the dream alive when it doesn't look, just as we've got to keep the dream of Vatican II alive in a situation where the danger is that the church could retract and become more secure. Do you get me? When the dream is still there, the wonderful, inspired thing that happened. The sun, chapter 60, verse 19, the sun shall no longer be your light by day, nor for brightness shall the moon give light to you by night. Poetry. Yahweh will be your everlasting light. Your God will be your glory. Beautiful, isn't it? Your sun will no longer go down. Your moon won't set. Yahweh will be your everlasting light, and the days of mourning shall be ended. That's our dream. And the book of Revelation, which I won't read to you now, is full of similar imagery. Or maybe I will. The last couple of chapters of Revelation pick up this Isaiah dream. The city has no need of sun or moon to shine in it, for the glory of God is its light, and the lamp is the Lamb. Where are they getting their music from here? There'll no more night. They'll need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light and will reign forever and ever. So at the end of the first century AD of the Christian period, the author of John of the book of Revelation is seeing in this spread of the Christian church, a persecuted church, by the way. So we're not talking about lack of suffering, but we're talking about meaning that takes people through suffering, because it captures their hearts. It's true. It's real. Isaiah 61, verses 1 to 3, is in the exact centre of this three chapters that we're now looking at, 60 to 62. So there's some reason for it. It's highly structured, all this, and this is right at the very hinge of these chapters. The prophet preachers are asserting their claim to have been anointed by Yahweh to carry on the mission given to Israel. That's an assertion that's been made right through the exile and now post-exile. And when the people failed to take it up, it was taken up by the school of prophet preachers of the exile. They see themselves, this is the Isaiah school, as the promised offspring who are commissioned to keep Yahweh's prophetic word alive. The Isaiah school saw themselves as inheriting the prophetic spirit, and here's the text which is quoted at the very beginning of Jesus' public ministry by the Gentile Luke, who saw the Christian community from the outside. He's the only one who did. They're all the rest of Jews, the rest of the authors of the New Testament. So you've got Luke seeing it, thinking, this is marvellous, because he was kind of fresh, coming in as an adult, and wasn't caught up in the system, because a lot of the Jewish Christians resisted the movement, because they'd been taught ever since they were little, and we do tend to, you know, want to. So they were kind of, no, you've got to be circumcised, you know, all that stuff about what Paul had to oppose. And this. So here's an outsider looking at it, getting to know Paul, picking up the vision, describing it all, and so when he stages the very first homily given by Jesus in his own hometown of Nazareth, Jesus finds this text. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. This is the importance of words, isn't it? He's picking up the words from Isaiah, from the post-exilic Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because Yahweh has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives and release to prisoners. And the main prison, of course, is in the head and the heart. That kind of liberation. To proclaim the year of Yahweh's favour and the day of vindication of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to provide for those who mourn in Zion, to give them a garland instead of ashes. That's what Jesus did. They're all fasting, they've all got ashes, they're all doing all the religious things, they're genuflecting and they're bowing and they're scraping and they're taking holy water out of the font. They're all good things to do, but they're going on and on and on about all this, and they're not happy, and they're not released, and they're not free, and they're not generous, and they're not really in communion with God. You get me? We're kind of us poor human beings doing what we're told, but we're not actually. Nietzsche was the one who said, if Christians only looked more redeemed, he might believe them. They all look pretty serious and sour, as far as he thought, so it wasn't a great advertisement for Christianity. So I'm going to give them garland instead of ashes. The bridegroom is with you, he says. So come on, Mary of Magdala, cheer up. Great, you're a woman caught in adultery, thief, leper, thief on a cross. Today you'll be with me in paradise. Holy smoke. You should have at least been through the third rite and gone to the RCIA first. how can you do all this? How can you act so quickly? You've got to, you know, Devonshire. Oh. I'll give an oil of gladness instead of mourning, a mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. Isaiah 62, for Zion's sake I will not keep silent, says the prophet. For Jerusalem's sake I will not rest until her vindication shines out like the dawn and her salvation like a burning torch. The nations shall see your vindication. All kings will see your glory. You shall be called by a new name that the mouth of Yahweh will give. You shall be a crown of beauty in the hand of Yahweh, a royal diadem in the hand of your God. And my small comment, when the prince was crowned king, he was given a throne name that expressed the hopes placed in him by the people. Yahweh intends to establish his kingdom in Judah. He has a royal crown in his hand, ready to crown his bride when the time is right. And the text goes on in verse 4. This is, you shall no more be termed forsaken. Your land shall no more be termed desolate, but you shall be called, Hebrew, Hephzibah. That's Hephzibah. My delight is in her, and your land will be called Beulah, married. For Yahweh delights in you. This is God. See, we're pussyfooting around. We include yourself if you want to. Chapters we just did. Struggling around doing our best and not doing our best and getting it all wonky. Yahweh hasn't changed. That's the point of all this. Yahweh delights in you. Delights in the thief on the cross. Delights in Pilate. Maybe Pilate listened. It'd be pretty hard to look into the eyes of Jesus. That's if Pilate did look into his eyes. He might have been just officiating. I don't know what he did. But when you get to heaven and find Pilate there and you say, what are you doing here? And you say, well, I talked to Jesus, which is a bit more than you ever did, and he got to me in the end, probably. And Judas will be there almost. How could you be hugged by Jesus in the garden and be so messed up that you went and suicided without... So I think Peter's probably his secretary. You never know. The first will be last, or the last will be first. It's all, go for it. You can always love at the last minute and then you're straight into heaven. As a young man marries a young woman, so shall your builder, God, marry you. As the bridegroom rejoices in his bride, so shall your God rejoice over you. And we conclude, they shall be called the holy people, the redeemed of Yahweh, and you shall be called sought out, a city not forsaken. If you want to go back to Isaiah ben Amoz, a highway will be there, it will be called the Holy Way. It shall be for God's people, the redeemed shall walk there. If you've been to Rome and seen the Via Sacra in the Forum, the Holy Way, Via Sacra, that's what the Roman equivalent. The Via Sacra is just the road going through the middle of the, and it goes up onto the Capitoline Hill where the temple of Jupiter used to be, the Via Sacra. Here's Isaiah 62, we just read it. You shall be called a holy people, redeemed of Yahweh. Here, you shall no more be termed forsaken, quoted again. Your land will no longer be called desolate. You shall be called, my delight is in her, and your land married, for Yahweh delights in you, and your land shall be married.